Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the search for minerals is leading some corporations to begin mining the ocean floor. But scientists warn that this could devastate fragile ecosystems and will have repercussions that we still don't understand. What is going on in the deep sea? And first, what are the parts of the U.S. political system that will most affect the election outcome?
We've got three experts with us. Associate Professor Jennifer Frost. She teaches at the University of Auckland American History, and she's the author of Let Us Vote, Youth Voting Rights and the 26th Amendment. Also with us is University of Auckland Politics and Policy Lecturer Tim Fadgen, who's also an American lawyer, and he's the author of Mental Health, Public Policy in Global Context. And also joining us is Professor Hans Noel. He's a professor at Georgetown University of Political Science. He's the author of Political Ideologies and Political Parties in America, co-author of The Party Decides, Presidential Nominations Before and After Reform. We've got about 5 weeks before the big election, 2020, and so many complex factors that could affect this upcoming election between all of the 50 states and the secretaries of state systems and electoral colleges and a new Supreme Court nominee. What could affect this outcome and how does this compare to history? Jennifer Frost, can we get a historic context on this?
You definitely start with the historical context, even though, as historians, we say, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. It really is going back to basics that the United States is a republic, and it was formed in rebellion against the British monarchy, and it's based on popular sovereignty. So that idea that the people have the authority and power to rule. Another point to make historically is that the structure and form of government in the United States really was a compromise and is a work in progress. So the electoral process is also then a compromise and a work in progress. How is the president chosen? Coming into the Constitutional Convention, there were those who said, let's have it be just like we choose the Senate. So it could be the state legislatures will choose the presidents. And then there was the idea of popular election or direct election. The Electoral College is then a compromise between these two ideas, where the state legislatures choose electors, and then the electors choose the president. The number of electors is, first of all, based on the federal representation that a state has in Congress, and then how those electors are chosen and how they are to fulfill their role is mostly determined by state law as well as some federal laws. But I guess the point I would just want to make here is the Electoral College was a compromise, and also this idea that the U.S. Constitution and form of government and electoral process is a work in progress. And I'll just very quickly mention the Electoral College has been up for debate for amendment many times in U.S. history, most substantially in the 1960s, most recently. And we've also had four other amendments to the U.S. Constitution that deal with the electoral process. It just shows you that it's been understood to be a work in progress how the U.S. electoral system works.
Today, it seems there's an extraordinary amount of anxiety about what's going to happen. The most polarized, according to polarization scholars, that America has been since the Civil War. And so we're really in a point of heightened concern. And I wonder, in addition to what you just described, if Hans Noel, you can come in and tell us a bit about what are all these other factors that we're going to be dealing with? We've got the secretaries of state. We've got the gerrymandering. We've got who gets to vote. We've got the Electoral College. Will they be faithful? Will they be unfaithful? Possibility of a tie. Then it goes to the Congress. Hans Noel, what could possibly go wrong in all this?
I mean, there's a lot of things that could go either wrong or unexpectedly, whether that be wrong or not. Because one thing to note is that the system as described that we've just laid out there, that's sort of the framework, the rules, and then in response to those from the beginning, politicians have been, you know, adapting and reacting to them in interesting ways. I mean, from the beginning, as we just heard, you know, sort of very clearly explained, the Electoral College is this compromise between, you know, two goals, and part of that compromise was a vision about how are we going to get different views of what's the right, most just, best possible leader to be chosen. And there was no notion of, say, political parties in the way that that was articulated. And then almost immediately, politicians started saying, well, I got friends, I got allies, I got people I want to be elected alongside. And it became clear that the Electoral College, as structured, wasn't going to, was not going to, you know, help them do that. Initially, the Electoral College, whoever comes in first is president, whoever comes in second was vice president. That's going to be problematic if the first place is one party and the second place is the second party. Eventually, there's an amendment that addresses that. But even before that, they start to be trying to, like, figure out how to outmaneuver the Electoral College to solve that problem. And so fast forward to now, I mean, we're in the same boat where everybody is facing the same rules that were in place that have been, that have grown up over all this time, and attempting to potentially outmaneuver them to try to achieve their partisan goals. And, you know, partisan goals are not inherently bad. I mean, the political party is trying to get elected because it thinks that what it wants to do for the country is a good thing. But with sometimes Byzantine rules spread across the country, they're going to do sometimes very complicated and Byzantine things. And the way that you describe it, I think, is right, to think about the election as really 51 elections across the state and in the District of Columbia, where each of those states holds an election. And then actually a little bit more complicated than that, because most of the states allocate their Electoral College votes. Whoever wins the state gets all the Electoral College votes. Two states do it that way for some of them, and then also allocate votes by congressional district. So it's a little bit even more than just that. And so all that little adjusting and jiggering across all the places, and all of that administration is done at the state level. This is the key thing. The United States is an aggressively federal system, especially when it comes to elections. So while it's a national election for the president and for Senate and for members of the House, those elections are actually administered at the state level. And every state has its own rules about what counts, has its own rules about when voting can start. Some voting has already begun. People have been able to actually go just across the border from me in the state of Virginia. People have already been voting. Here in Washington, D.C., I'm waiting for a ballot to be mailed to me to vote. In other places, you can't vote at all until the actual day of the election. When they're allowed to start counting those ballots, what counts as a properly sent in mail ballot, if it is mail, all of those things are different at the state level and administered at the state level. And then the rules are set at the state level, but of course some states then delegate to counties to actually administer things and to decide who gets to receive an absentee ballot or something. So devolved even further, which means that the avenues for a legal challenge or some kind of complication are spread all over the place.
So Hans Noll, before we go to Tim Fadjin, you made two mentions. One is a Byzantine system, and the other was how historically parties have tried to sort of outmaneuver those rules. What is happening today in terms of trying to outmaneuver those so-called Byzantine rules that have been brought to your attention and that you might have concern about?
Let me first say that outmaneuvering the rules is politics to a certain degree. Like, you have the rules and you say, okay, well, we're allowed to do this, and so this is what we will do. And so in the U.S. system, you have a first-past-the-post logic, and so you tend to have two parties, but that's sort of a natural thing. But what I think causes concern is more a fear that there'll be implementation of barriers and rules that aren't just, well, let me respond in an optimal way to the rules, but let me try to manipulate or discourage people from voting and the like because of what the way the rules are. So for example, mail-in voting is something that is in some parts of the country been practiced for a very, very long time. So I grew up in the state of Oregon, and Oregon first implemented mail-in balloting way back. The initial moves were in the 80s and 90s, and they've been voting for the president by mail, but since 2000. But other states have been implementing more recently. And then of course, with the concerns about the coronavirus, other administrations, including here in Washington, D.C., where I am now, said, oh, hey, well, you know, let's do this now. Let's make this easier for people who can't go to the polls because it's not safe. So that's been this suddenly increase in this way of voting that for some people seems new. Although even places like here, where it's new that everyone is going to be voting by mail, there's always been absentee ballots. But it seems a little bit different and a little bit new. And so one thing that's been happening then is that some people, including the president, have been saying, oh, that's ripe for fraud. That's dangerous, because if you can vote by mail, then someone can get access to your ballot and manipulate it, or they can capture ballots that have been sent out and someone can steal that and vote inappropriately. There are actually tons of safeguards that are built into the system to prevent that sort of thing. Among others, if you're in a place where you can both vote by mail and in person, and you vote by mail and then you show up in person, there will be a record that both things have happened and you won't be able to vote twice. But the concerns about that have been introduced. Well, oh, now I'm worried. I don't know what I'm allowed to do. And I did a panel on this at Georgetown, people asking questions, and there were lots of people proposing, oh, you can't do this. This is illegal. Only that's possible. And there's a lot of misinformation about it. So not only does the misinformation cause a problem, because people now aren't sure how they're allowed to vote, and that might discourage some people. But then once they have voted, if they voted appropriately, there may be some legal challenges. For example, in Pennsylvania, there's a question about whether or not the state will count a ballot if it's been mailed in, but the ballot has not been placed inside the second privacy envelope. So the procedure is that you get the ballot, you vote, you put it inside one sealed envelope that has no labeling and marking of any sort, and then you put it inside the next envelope that does indicate where you're sending it from and so forth. So then when they get the ballot, they can confirm that, in fact, this is your ballot from you, and then they can tear it open and then it's sealed otherwise. If somehow that was messed up, then what has been done in the past is that the person who's opening it's like, okay, well, they made a mistake, but we will do our best to make sure this ballot gets shepherded through in a safe way. But now there's been a challenge that, well, maybe we shouldn't count those ballots. Well, that could be a large number of people who made a simple mistake and then their ballots aren't counted. And it's not obvious to me what one should do when there's a snafu like this, or for that matter, how widespread those sorts of things happen. In the same way that it's not obvious to me what should happen in a situation in say 2000, 20 years ago, when we had this unorthodox butterfly ballot in Florida that caused some uncertainty about what the outcome was in Florida. And we know, how do you know how to, what, like, it seems obvious that these people voted one way, but the ballot was confusing. And so the vote was recorded in a different way. So those kinds of things open up an opportunity for a lawsuit. And what you'd hope is that people would say, we should find the way to most best possible convey what we think the voter's intention was. But when you have a bunch of partisan views on both sides, that can open up an opportunity for other kinds of challenges. Once you've got that kind of challenge, then the courts conceivably get involved. And that is not what is intended. The system is not intended to be resolved by the courts, but once the courts get involved, things could get ugly.
As they did in 2000, as you mentioned, which ended up in a very partisan decision to essentially stop the counting of the votes, which, as I understand, had they counted the votes, we would have had a different outcome.
And the consequences of that election and that decision we know are great, because in a putting together Al Gore versus George W. Bush, most scholars have argued that Al Gore would not have invaded Iraq as part of going after al-Qaeda and their attack on September 11th. So the consequences of that are great. I think it's really important to remember that the courts don't have an official role in the electoral process under the Constitution. And Bush v. Gore, they made the decision that that decision would not have precedent. So it's an incredibly unique Supreme Court decision to make a decision and then say, but we're not going to have this decision lay precedent for the future. So right there, it shows what an anomaly that decision was. And obviously, in the end, an undemocratic decision for the populace.
Tim Fadgen, you've been sitting there nice and quietly. What do you say about all this?
I think that last point really jumped out to me. Speaking as political scientists and probably historians, we spend a lot of our time studying declining voter turnout and thinking about what do we do to increase voter turnout. And it seems like a lot of the rhetoric that we get in the media, especially this year, and reporting from political strategists is, how many barriers can we erect? How many obstacles can we put in the way? And some of it is framed, obviously, as protecting the integrity of the election, which are, of course, important considerations to have. But it's just telling, I think, of the time that we're in, that we spend so much more time thinking about all the barriers and obstacles put in place, as opposed to this democratic value of trying to get as many people into the process as we can. And there was a time, I suppose, when we worried a lot more about that. than we do about some of these other things. To Hans's point, there's been a lot of reporting about the thousands of election lawyers who are being trained up and equipped with pre-drafted pleadings and sent to swing states and contested polling sites all across the country. And as Hans was just saying, you know, there's these obstacles that lead up to the election for where people can vote. But then there are all these rules and worry about whether each step of the process is being adhered to and what the outcome could be. And that's what these lawyers seem to be focused on. And I suppose those who observe the United States from outside won't be surprised that lawyers are involved and that courts are involved.
You know, that's a great point. I mean, should we be more concerned today about the integrity of the system than we have in the past?
Well, I hate to say it, but the system has never been perfect, right? And I guess that's, again, you know, this idea that it's a work in progress, you know, that over time it has changed. But the electorate has gotten more expansive. And then the ways in which we cast our ballots have changed over time. It used to be a public how you were voting, and everybody was around and could see how you were voting and push you, peer pressure, economic pressure to vote in a certain way. I'm talking about like the 19th century. You know, we've, you know, had political machines who've, you know, really run things, or ward bosses. So we've got to remember that the system has never function perfectly. We're human beings, and we create these structures, and we're trying to implement them as best we can. But I think that's where the motivations come in, as Tim mentioned, as Hans mentioned. You know, what are the motivations of the people who are overseeing the process? Is it to include in as many people as possible, hear as many voices as possible, or is it to exclude?
And whether or not it is, as Hans mentioned, the partisan nature today, and how the founders, the framers of the Constitution, hadn't prepared properly for big political parties and the roles that they would be playing inside and outside of each state and in the federal system. So, Hans Noel, how much concern should we have about the integrity of the system, and where should we be concerned?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely there's plenty of reason to be concerned. And I think Jennifer's point that this is not new, right? There's been lots of reasons and, you know, points historically when we've had as much or more concern is definitely the right way to think about it. And yet, I would say right now, there feels to be like some sort of a level of backsliding on the level of integrity in the system. That is, you know, at the height of Jim Crow, we saw a lot of concerns, a lot of difficulties, and then we did a lot about it. The Voting Rights Act made progress towards a system that was meant to address some of these concerns. And then on the specific issues of the Voting Rights Act, with the Shelby decision that removed some of the elements of the Voting Rights Act that made it enforceable, we have specifically in states implementing rules that can bring us back to those kinds of restrictions. But I think the other thing that is particularly unique right now, or at least unique in my lifetime, let's say, is the degree to which lots of people have doubts about the quality of the system and are trying to exploit those doubts. It's always been difficult to know what the count is. I do a lot of work with election data, and depending on what source you go to, the numbers you get are incredibly different one place to place. We've never known the exact count. Just fortunately, the margins have been large enough that it usually doesn't change the outcomes. And as long as we believe that whatever the results were are good enough, then we move forward. But the idea that we are accusing the other side of extensive fraud and therefore casting doubt on the outcome and therefore leaving open the possibility that we might just not trust the results and therefore maybe not abide by them, that's really problematic. That kind of lack of respect to the integrity of the system is the kind of thing that is, you know, Reconstruction era and end of Reconstruction era, you know, Rutherford B. Hayes kind of language. That's the election that ended Reconstruction was resolved on a compromise about an election result that people didn't trust. Some people didn't believe that the outcome was legitimate. I worry about politicians exploiting that today, deliberately doing so. That is the kind of thing that we are embracing on a level that did not happen in 2000, when there was a lot of doubt and uncertainty about the outcome. You didn't have people saying, and I don't think the other side is trying to have a fair election. Maybe they're trying to exploit and, you know, they've got their lawyers and are trying to get as much as they can, but not that they were actually out there doing fraudulent voting. That kind of charge really undermines trust in the system.
So I wonder if we could look at the overall system and think in terms of what are going to play the biggest factors in this upcoming election, in how much each of these aspects that we've been talking about, at least touching on, are going to matter. And what are the big issues that you see pushing into one direction or another the outcome of the election?
On the one hand, just to kind of respond in a sense to what Hans was just saying, I think thinking to that 1876 election is kind of interesting. I'm not a historian, but at least looking at it from the brokering of the presidency and thinking about the vacancy on the Supreme Court. But I wonder to the extent that that at least gives the Republicans in Congress, should it be contested, the ability, political ability, cover, so to speak, to say, okay, well, we've got the court pretty much locked up. There doesn't seem to be a lot of support at this stage from Biden, at least publicly, to support a court packing initiative. But I wonder if we do end up in this sort of, with weeks after the election, of these absentee and other ballots still being counted, provisional ballots being counted in some of these swing states in particular, that we end up in a situation like that again, where it's sort of brokered behind closed doors. I guess I don't know, given the range of things we've talked about, the situation just seems to be so fluid. One of the key differences between this and even 2000 and going back is just the constant barrage of news and information that people have and how people are responding in real time to what seem to be significant norm breaking. Just a series of issues like that that I think it's almost too soon to tell what will be the sort of critical issue. But I do think that there's just so many balls in the air this time.
Perhaps that's part of this sense of anxiety coming from the U.S. Hans Noll, how do you see it? What are the systemic issues that you think are going to most affect the outcome?
Everybody feels a little bit disconnected from things because while I'm right here, I'm looking at the whole country through Zoom just like everybody else. The first thing that I think matters for a lot of people, which is this is a really weird year and a weird election, and the coronavirus situation is just, how do I think about that in terms of government and in terms of the performance of the incumbent? I think broadly, for most people, what that means is frustration that we are still in the midst of something that many places around the world have managed to either get out of it or get out of and then are, you know, in the second wave, perhaps, but we're still really in the first wave with the pandemic. So much evidence that the administration has either botched handling it or, if to be more charitable, not handled it as well as they've claimed to have handled it. If you're a voter, that's got to be frustrating. One of the things that voters do is that they're just, you know, judging how well did the administration handle things, then this is going to be a piece of that. And then I think related to that is just the economy in general. So always the economy is going to matter, and the economy is not doing so great, in part because of the coronavirus. And you can start to say, well, are things turning back and light recovery after the worst of the coronavirus, but it's still not good for most people. And so that too is something that I think people are going to be frustrated with. That doesn't bode well for the incumbent. I mean, those are two really big things that I think matter a lot for people evaluating things. And then I think for a lot of deeply partisan people, they'll tell you a lot of other stuff. What's going on with the Supreme Court seat replacement? And a lot of people I talk to are really worked up about that and really, you know, think that matters a great deal and are really outraged that Republicans who insisted that you couldn't replace Scalia in 2016 from February on, but are quick to and are comfortable to replace Ginsburg from September on in 2020, and that is hypocritical and outrageous. A lot of people that feel like that really matters a lot for them. But I suspect that most of the people who are saying that would have voted for Biden already and were already there. So I think for most of the people who are, their votes would be more surprising or more up in the air, it really is performance questions and frustration with the way that Trump has done things on those straightforward performance questions and just on like integrity of the office, like what you expect out of a president has grown wearying for a lot of people.
So let me ask you guys about one other thing that we haven't really talked about, which is 2016 and the possibility of foreign interference in the election. There's some chance of this, is there not?
It's interesting that I hadn't even considered that today until you just mentioned it. And it was such an incredibly important issue up until now. Somehow it's managed to be pushed down the list of worries to a lower place. Not to say that people on social media aren't susceptible to it anymore, but we're at least more aware that it's ongoing. And the media is talking about it more. The FBI director has testified about it. It's a lot more out in the public sphere than it was before it leading up to 2016. And I think that that's a key difference. The maybe more to our conversation today that we haven't talked about, and maybe it's because it hasn't been developed more, is the fact that I suppose that Russia was able to sort of interface with one of the election systems in one of the states, and they didn't interfere with anything. But apparently or allegedly, they had some access to it.
And allegedly, it's extraordinarily easy to access these and tinker with them.
Right, which is why I suppose maybe the fact that we're not hearing about that so much is good, but it could also be a worrisome sign, because what they are talking about more is the social media kind of bought that vehicle and not so much about this.
Hans Knoll.
So from a social science perspective, a lot of times we think about what is it that we can actually demonstrate is actually happening as opposed to what do we think might be happening. And this is the problem with this, is that it's hard to know whatever manipulation efforts have happened, how effective they actually were. What the Mueller report and what the other investigations and what everything else reveals is that it's fairly clear that Russia wanted to influence the election and was keen to try to do so, tried to, and made steps to influence the election, and is also, broadly speaking, also trying to do so now. Well, there's less evidence, but it's impossible that the Trump campaign knew about this or might have done something, get engaged with it, and so forth. But that was less clear in the Mueller report. The Mueller report was very clear that the Trump administration tried to cover up whatever they had done, tried to, you know, obstruct justice, probably. That was pretty clear in the Mueller report. What was not clear in any of that was whether or not any of the Russians' attempts were actually effective in affecting the outcome of the election, right? That's another question. That's a lot trickier, because most people who are really highly engaged with politics, enough to be paying attention to political communication on social media, probably already are going to vote the way they're going to vote. Not everybody, but a lot of them are. And then the ones that are going to be, you know, getting misinformation and so forth, a lot of them are going to use that misinformation to maybe like push open a door that was already kind of halfway open. So there's already going in that direction. And so is that enough to make the difference? Well, I mean, I would say that 2016 was such a razor thin election, 70, 80,000 votes in three states that go the other way, or, you know, voted in different places or did or didn't vote, and you get a different outcome. So any small thing could affect it. Like all kinds of tiny things could have mattered. So I guess this could have mattered too. But the magnitude of the effect might not be that large. And the people who have spent more time digging more deeply into what actually was the effect of the social media manipulation, like on Facebook and so forth, in terms of actually affecting voters, have not found huge effects. That's partly because it's just maybe hard to find the effects, right? So it could be that the effects were significant and it's just hard to find them. But it seems to me that the story on the Russian interference is much more serious, in that it's telling that Russia wants to be involved and what they want out of the election, and less telling about like that they're able to manipulate the election. I think our system is fragile in lots and lots of ways, but one thing that the Electoral College does do is it makes it hard to run up the score in one place, because if you can go in and manipulate, you know, actually hack the machines in Detroit, you can flip Michigan, but that might not be enough. Then you also have to be able to hack them in another state or something, right? And so the social media targeting has to be across multiple states. It was, and so maybe that was enough to do something. There we start to have less of a clear story that it actually was as effective. And then, as you say, this year we're more aware of it, and that may be enough to then inoculate us a bit about what's going on. I'm not sanguine about it. I'm also not completely convinced that we know that there was a huge effect.
So, Jennifer Frost, anything you want to respond to on that? But also, I was reading The Hill this morning, and they were talking about the possibility of a tie, 269 to 269 electoral votes, and what would happen in that case. What can we learn from history on that, too?
One point I did want to make just about the integrity of the system is that, you know, the secretaries of state and people who are in charge also in the territories and in D.C.
We're talking about the secretaries of state on the state level.
Yeah, on the state level. You know, again and again, they're saying this system has integrity. Voter fraud is absolutely minimal. So, you know, I think we do have these voices of calm that are trying to say the system has integrity. We are looking after that. And my experience voting from abroad has just been fantastic. It's good for us to remember, yes, we are anxious, but there are people whose job it is to ensure that these elections run with integrity.
And some of them actually do.
Yes. I guess the thing about the Electoral College is interesting because I started off by talking about it as a compromise. The number of electors in the Electoral College are based on the federal representatives that the states have. So depending on how many senators, well, everybody has two senators, and how many representatives you have, that's your number of electors. So this is where we see how undemocratic the Electoral College is, because this is where smaller states have greater representation in the Electoral College. So that process used to be thought of as a, you know, kind of a stop on, you know, possible corruption or problems with the candidate, et cetera. Because it's so undemocratic, it's not quite functioning in that way, you know, to ensure the best candidate is selected. So what we are going to look at then is, you mentioned 1876. 1888 was another election that had Electoral College issues. And we have had, you know, those cases where the person who won the popular vote loses to the person who gets the Electoral College. So that did happen in the U.S. in the past. What's just striking is that it has now happened twice in the 21st century and potentially could happen again. And this is where we start to really think about the legitimacy of the overall structure of government and the electoral process. It could all come down to that, and we might have to have a commission that looks at it. This could be playing out. The stakes are high for the system to be seen as legitimate, and the Electoral College really can play a part in that.
Thank you so much, Hans Noll, for joining us, Tim Fadjin, Jennifer Frost. What a great pleasure this has been talking about this with you all. Thank you so much for joining us.
When we come back, mining the bottom of the sea for minerals. What are the repercussions, and how can we prevent devastating fragile ecosystems in the ocean? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The world's thirst for more minerals has corporations and others now turning to mine a region of the world that had previously been left relatively undisturbed, the ocean floor. What might the ramifications of mining the deep sea be on the ocean's ecosystem health? What precautions should be taken to prevent devastating the fragile ecosystems? With us are two experts. Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada Research Chair in Deep Ocean Research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe.
This new exploration of deep sea mining, there seems to be conflicting thoughts about this. On one hand, we could be severely damaging the ocean ecosystems in ways that we don't understand. On the other, I understand these metals are sort of needed for a renewable revolution. So are we just trading one environmental disaster for another?
First of all, I want to say that I'm a scientist and I'm not for or against mining, but I think everybody that's involved, all stakeholders, need to know the consequences of activities that are undertaken, for example, in the deep ocean for deep sea mining. And it's pretty clear that deep sea mining, especially for polymetallic nodules or manganese nodules, as they are also called, will have a major environmental footprint. It'll cause substantial damage over thousands to hundreds of thousands of kilometers of seafloor. So the environmental impacts will be major, and the changes, the harm to the ecosystems will be permanent, essentially, because there are organisms that live nowhere else but on these nodules on the bottom of the ocean. And when you take them away, it takes millions of years for them to grow. Now, if we step back and look at things on a global scale, society may decide that it is worth these environmental costs to mine these metals from the seafloor for electric vehicle batteries, etc. But that's not a judgment I can make. I can't really judge the economics and environmental impacts in other ecosystems, but I can judge what they will be in the deep sea. And it's important to recognize that they will be substantial.
Well, let's talk about the deep sea for a moment. So I've been looking at some of your papers, and it says that we've got really a huge amount of the world's ocean there, volume representing the largest and least explored biome on Earth. What can you tell us about what we have studied to date and what we know about this part of the planet in the ocean?
What we do know about the deep sea is that it's very heterogeneous. There are lots of different kinds of habitats and different kinds of biodiversity. For example, hydrothermal vents are one very remarkable type of ecosystem where there are giant tube worms and all kinds of novel organisms adapted to this extreme environment. And we also have other kinds of habitats like seamounts that are very different from hydrothermal vents or from nodule fields and different biodiversity. And the nodule fields themselves are really unusual, radically different from other parts of the deep sea. And they have also very high biodiversity and a huge list of undescribed species that are new to science. Most of the species we haven't collected, and those that we have collected are new to science. So, and we can say that the deep sea in general harbors remarkable biodiversity and lots of different ecosystems, but we still are very early on in characterizing this biodiversity.
So for those of us who are not marine biologists or marine ecologists, what are all these critters you've just been talking about?
Well, some of them are giant tube worms that are a couple meters long. There are lots of different kinds of worms, polychaete worms that have amazing adaptations. I mean, some of them don't look like worms at all. They look like big orange floating animals, balloons. And then there are lots of different kinds of crustaceans and actually quite a high diversity of deep sea fishes.
Farina?
What are the animals? They are denizens of the deep that we never see further up. For us living on land, they represent the inhabitants of an alien world that seems to be totally unconnected with us. And yet, we're talking about ecosystems that have adapted to their environment for millennia after millennia. So there's an intrinsic value in these bizarre things, which us scientists give all sorts of wonderful names to. You can create stories about each one of these little critters, and I love the little stories, but so what? The so what really comes in the concept of the deep ocean being an integrated part of our planet that we're only just understanding. Whereas humans have had impact for tens to hundreds of thousands of years on the land, we haven't really got there much in the deep ocean. It's getting there. We're starting to affect the deep sea. But this is a place that has yet to really feel the full hammer of human ambition. And why these ecosystems might matter to us is part of that whole connectedness. So, for example, the ocean serves as a huge sink for the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere. And the biggest reservoir of carbon dioxide on our planet is in the deep ocean. It's being pulled down. And so one of the services these ecosystems do for us is processing our foolishness in putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So there's things they do for us. There's ways in which our food production is connected to the deep sea. So if one believes in the ecosystems of the planet working together, these do represent our most furthest ones and the ones we know the least about. But for that very reason, those knowledge gaps and stepping carefully becomes really important.
So Verinda Tunnicliffe, we opened the conversation about this juxtaposition between the drive to renewable energy, which is part of why they're driving to mine in the deep ocean, to stop putting carbon dioxide into the air, and yet the possibility of trading one ecological disaster for another, and whether that deep sea mining is just going to be so irreparable that it's kind of counter affects the good that might come from getting those minerals. Do you have a sense of that?
I have a sense of the question. It's a risk analysis one makes. And one interesting question is it going to make any difference in the long run? Partly the place I'm going is that I'm not sure we're going to change anything with land-based mining, for one thing. Simply because if it's there, we're going to go for it. For feeding the renewables market, one issue is if we keep feeding the same minerals into it and making access to the minerals, are we curbing the innovations that will begin to wean us off the need for those particular minerals? I mean, I'm not a technologist in terms of how batteries work, but I do understand there are other potential ways of building batteries. There are other potential kinds of energy resources. So at what point do we stop and think about how we work in terms of needing or using those metals versus, okay, here's another source, so let's just go for it? Are we having the right social discussion? And it is time to include humankind. This is the heritage of humankind on the seafloor. That's part of the law of the sea. And so perhaps the social conversation needs to happen to understand all aspects of it.
And part of that discussion needs to be a really objective assessment of what the impact of mining will be. A major issue is that I'm absolutely convinced that the potential impacts of mining are being minimized. They're being glossed over because most of the general public doesn't know enough about the deep sea to realize that some of the statements about what these impacts will be like are just unrealistic and purposely naive, I think.
So what should the public know?
I think the public should know, for example, I'm particularly specialist on manganese nodule ecosystems and what mining impacts will be, that these are, number one, the most pristine habitats on the planet. Yes, there are some microplastics make it down there, but in general, these are the largest, you know, habitat areas of wilderness left on the planet. And they also are among the most stable and probably the least resilient to human disturbances of any ecosystem. For example, mining will inevitably raise a sediment plume or resuspend sediment and put it up in the water column. And the Clipperton Clarion Zone has the clearest bottom waters on the planet, clearer than anywhere else in the ocean. They're so clear that their bottom waters are clear, there's less suspended sediment or particles than in the clear surface waters of the ocean. If you go in the middle of the most nutrient-poor oceans, the water is not as clear as it is in the bottom of the Clipperton Clarion Zone. So what that tells you is these communities are adapted to very low concentrations of sediment particles. They have all kinds of adaptations that are dependent on these conditions. And so when you perturb this ecosystem by resuspending large plumes of sediment, you'll bury animals, you interfere with their ability to respire, you'll smother them, not just animals, but also microbes or bacteria, et cetera. And also, most of the animals in the deep sea use light in their ecology. They create light. And sediment plumes will black this out. It'll be dark clouds of sediment preventing organisms from finding mates, from finding prey, etc. So these are very stable ecosystems in the Clipperton Clarion Zone. They're a target for nodule mining, and they also have really high diversity, some of the highest diversities of seafloor communities anywhere in the ocean. And we don't really know why. We know that that's true, but we don't know what processes are driving that.
Verena Tunnicliffe, would you add anything to that?
I think I'd love the public to know a little bit about the ecosystem that I love in the deep sea, which is hydrothermal hot vents. And the particular issue here is that the hot vent ecosystem has its own group of species that live there. They're not found anywhere else in the world. And we've learned so much about the origin of life and life's adaptations in really extreme circumstances, to the point where the lessons from hydrothermal vents are now driving exploration in outer space. That's how fundamental the discoveries have been. And yet the size of these ecosystems is tiny. Unlike what Craig is talking about, fairly large areas in the abyss, the hydrothermal vents cluster around these tiny hot springs, which also form the deposits of interest to miners. And the animals are living on those deposits. Now, when we estimate the total area of hydrothermal vents in the world, we've got something that's maybe 30 to 50 square kilometers. That's it. That's tiny. Think of Central Park in New York City or some small island in the Caribbean. That's the total area. We are told that miners probably won't want to go next to near hot water. So that's great. I love to hear that. But we must put them under protection, officially under protection. If indeed they aren't going to mine them, and they do recognize that they're special, then they have to be entrenched in the regulations. And we're not quite hearing that discussion happening. So that's one of the three resources that's being targeted.
So in these vents that you're talking about, you said the critters are living on the deposits that have the very minerals that these companies and societies are therefore after.
The same is true on the nodules with their own critters growing on them. The same is true on the cobalt crusts on the seamounts. So on the seamounts, tops of seamounts, we have the ancient corals, we have the sponges, we have a diverse community that is on, I mean, you've got to remove the substratum and therefore the habitat's gone. And so for most of these habitats, the formation of that substratum has taken thousands to millions of years.
And one of the key things, and this is the way nature works, when you have a specialized habitat or a specialized set of conditions that produce a mineral resource, that's also a specialized habitat. So where you find minerals that are remarkably rich in metals that can be used in batteries on the seafloor anywhere, it's going to be a different kind of ecosystem than places that don't have those minerals. And so you have specially adapted communities. And so you can't harvest a remarkable and unusual resource on the seafloor without damaging an unusual community. That's how life works. That's how evolution works.
And then if they do end up damaging that community, what you are saying is that we don't really know the repercussions that might trickle beyond that, the interconnection of the ecosystems.
Yep.
Marina, I see you nodding.
Yep. You think about things on land which have been, you know, removed for lifetimes, many, many people's lifetimes, and how mountain, you know, alpine regions have completely changed, or you've changed something over to agriculture and you've lost completely the original ecosystems. And to some extent, we don't even know how much we've already changed life on land. With the removal of the fundamental habitat, you are not going to see a quick reforestation or whatever you want, or restoration of the communities that are gone. And so part of the problem here is just understanding the ramifications of that and trying to model what that might look like when you have no baseline.
So what can we propose that might protect to some degree if they are determined to start mining in the oceans? How can we conserve what is necessary to protect life, protect biodiversity, protect the potential ripple effects to the rest of the planet?
There are a variety of approaches. One fundamental approach to protecting biodiversity and ecosystem functions is to protect enough of the ecosystems in the area that are being exploited, put them in no mining areas or marine protected areas so that you maintain biodiversity and the ecosystem functions, the services that are provided by that region. And that's being done to some degree and for nodule mining, and it's in the planning stages for mining of massive sulfides, the extinct vents. But that's just one thing. Spatial management is really important. Another thing that I think is really clearly important is what a lot of scientists call the precautionary approach, that you assume the worst reasonable scenario and you manage for that until you can show otherwise, that in fact the scale of impacts are less than the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. And so my feeling for manganese nodule mining is that in space and time scales of impacts are so poorly known that I really a responsible way to proceed with mining would be to start with one mining operation and really study it for the decades or so required to get a full understanding of the scales of impact. And if we see that it's enormous and it's really threatening biodiversity and ecosystem services in this whole area, then we stop at one. But if we see we can scale up from that. And I think most scientists would agree that one mining operation that Clifton Clarion Zone and probably one mining of an operation of a massive sulfide, if done properly with appropriate mitigation measures, et cetera, probably is not going to cause large-scale damage to the ocean and to biodiversity. So we probably can do it on a small scale and get an understanding of what the real ramifications are. Maybe Marina can comment. But I think that's really important, to the precautionary approach, that we proceed carefully one step at a time rather than just allowing large-scale mining to occur in lots of different places at lots of different, simultaneously.
Marina, would you agree?
I would, and I'm going to make a comment about the conservation of marine protected areas. Craig was very influential in getting some protected areas established in the nodule mining fields, but the problem that his team had was that the contracts were already signed and there was the spaces where you might choose to put the conservation areas weren't available. And the same thing is true for the hydrothermal vent system. So we've already got 30 contracts signed around the world for mining operations, and none of them were signed with the idea of where conservation areas should go in.
So where are the contracts that you know about? Where are they proposing to start mining?
Well, there are 16 in the Clipperton Clarion Zone, each of them up to 75,000 square kilometers. And then there are a number of other, they're called reserve areas, that are reserved for mining by developing nations or by the International Seabed Authority itself, the regulatory body that regulates mining in areas at the seabed and areas beyond national jurisdiction. And then Verena can comment on how many, there are some claim, I've forgotten exactly how many, I think it's six that are on seamount cobalt systems.
Yes, there are five or six. And those are mostly in the Western Pacific between Wake Island and Guam. And then there's one off Brazil, and those are for seamounts. And then there's an additional seven for hydrothermal vents, four in the Atlantic, and at least three in the Indian Ocean, which is a place we have very little exploration.
Which are the minerals that they are most after?
The metals that make the most economic drivers are nickel and cobalt. Those are the two big ones. And then you can make money from the copper and the manganese. And then there's other metals that can come out of them. Mm. The nodules are of particular interest because they have such a high concentration and that there isn't a whole lot of extra processing you have to do once you've got it through a processing plant.
I think gold is also a mineral of interest for the massive sulfides.
Yes, it is. Depends on the deposit. You aren't going to get a lot of gold out of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge sulfides.
I know the United Nations, as you guys mentioned, also is trying to put together some agreements about how we move forward, if we move forward with these. If we have enough marine protected areas, perhaps it won't be too devastating. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no.
Okay, good. Thank you.
You're saying, you asked us what was one way to mitigate, and that's the beginning of mitigation. But I think Craig's point of going slowly, here we are going into the decade of the ocean, a decade that's starting 2020 to try and understand more about our ocean, and maybe full steam ahead is perhaps not the best approach at the moment, perhaps beginning to look carefully and carefully monitor what would happen as we slowly move forward is really the best way to go, so that you can begin to do those designs of mitigation much more carefully.
Greg Smith?
Yeah, and I think one thing to recognize is that the pattern at which humans exploit resources. And stakeholders have said, well, you know, we're not going to mine all the mining claims in the Clipperton and Clarion Zone at once. We're, you know, the global market, metals market can't sustain that. So we're just going to mine one, and then we'll move over here and maybe mine another. Maybe there'll be two or three going on simultaneously. But the bottom line is the way humans exploit resources is once something's economically viable, they exploit it until it's gone. We're not leaving any oil in the ground, and now we're getting tar sands and things. So if it's economically viable and can be used in human society, the exploitation will keep going. And in the Clipperton-Clarion Zone, no area will have recovered from mining damage before the last area is mined, even if it's centuries from now. So you can't think of these individual mining operations in isolation. It's not just one mine, oh, we'll mine here, and then 20 years later we'll mine over here, and that first one will have recovered. No, it won't recover. It won't recover for millions of years. You've got to really think holistically and long-term about how you manage this. And marine protected areas are essential, but also having a good understanding of the scales of impact, both at the seafloor and the water column, and even connectivity to food webs to humans, are lacking, and those are really important to understand.
Well, Craig Smith and Verena Tunnicliffe, I thank you both so very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Your interest.
Craig Smith is a professor of oceanography at the University of Hawaii, and Verena Tunnicliffe is a marine biologist and a Canada Research Chair in Deep Ocean Research at the University of Victoria in Canada. They are co-authors of the study, Deep Sea Misconceptions Cause Underestimation of Seabed Mining Impacts. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.